Afternoon. It is one bell of the afternoon watch, and this is your Captain Joe up in the captain's chair today, broadcasting live as always from the Gene Bosch studio on the magical Isle of Vashon on Voice of Vashon 101.9 on the FM band at all of, I believe, about five booming watts, and stream live all over the world on voiceofvashon.org. And the Gene Bosch Studio sits right across the Vashon Highway southwest from the Vashon Presbyterian Church. And the notice board on the Presbyterian Church says, "Who needs your kindness today?" So I broadcast that because somebody out there certainly could use some of our kindness today. Greetings all over the world, especially to all of Captain Joe's people who live on islands and in Colville, Washington, and in Missouri, and in Bellevue, and from Singapore on one side of the world to the Kingdom of Sweden, and in particular the capital thereof, Stockholm, on the other side of the world. And all of the ships at sea and all of the aircraft in the air, all of which are carrying Captain Joe's people, come my greetings to you from the captain's chair today. Sad, sad, sad binnacle list entry. I am putting the entire sad, sorry world on the binnacle list today, and in particular the children and those who bear and care for them all over the world. But in particular, do I have something to say about what's happening in Ukraine and in Russia and in the Crimea and the Black Sea and all of that part of the world. We are, in a way, in yet another world war, because every one of us is being affected and is going to be affected even more so long as this terrible conflict goes on. And my heart goes out in particular to all of the people who are working with refugees, all of those millions of people who are streaming from one place to another. I mentioned last week that I had seen some of this in Vietnam, especially up by the DMZ. And it is always the children, the women who bear them and care for them in particular, who suffer the most and who cannot protect and defend themselves. And so it is my hope and my wish, my desire from the captain's chair, not that I can any longer influence world affairs, even in my small community of the poor community, not that I can any longer influence any of that, but maybe just a little bit of a ripple, a stone dropped into my own little pond here on the magical isle, which will ripple out and somehow reach those who are causing all of this to happen. End it so that we can return those children to their homes, for they have nothing, no influence of any kind, and yet their fate should weigh heavily on the hearts and minds and souls of all of us. My book this week is one that I have been carrying around with me for quite a while, and I am putting it at the top of my pile today so that I do indeed get it out. It is called Short Stories of the Sea. It is published by the Naval Institute Press. The Naval Institute, of course, is a wonderful organization. It goes back to 1876. And I am a Golden Life member. I've been a member for over 50 years and have been a part of the Institute. I've written a couple pieces for it, but never any long articles. And they also have the Naval Institute Press. So this book is published by the Naval Institute Press. It's called Short Stories of the Sea. And in particular, I have selected a story in it by the wonderful writer, the late wonderful writer, Nicholas Montserrat, who wrote one of my favorite and touchstone books, The Cruel Sea. This particular story is called HMS Marlborough Will Enter Harbor. And it's the story of a sloop, which is a little bit larger in British nomenclature, British World War II nomenclature, a little bit larger than one of the corvettes in which Montserrat served, and which is the scene of The Cruel Sea, corvettes in the Battle of the Atlantic. And Marlborough gets badly damaged. She gets badly torpedoed. And the story is about how she is saved. And what particularly struck me about this is a paragraph from it, which I'm going to read in its entirety, because it talks about the same kind of thing that we have talked about on this broadcast many times. The captain shall show no fear. He may fear it, he may feel it, and he certainly must, because he is human. So in this particular story, Marlborough has been badly damaged, and they're fighting to save their ship. And the paragraph goes, I'm quoting now from the story, HMS Marlborough will enter harbor in my book for today, which is Short Stories of the Sea, published by the Naval Institute Press. The captain, moving with purpose but without hurry, stepped onto the central compass platform, glanced once round him, and sat down. There was nothing special, or something special, not nothing, my goodness, something special in that act of sitting down, there in the middle of the noise and movement, reaching the bridge from all over the ship. And everyone near him caught it. The captain, on the bridge, sitting in the captain's chair. Of course, that was what they had been waiting for. It was the beginning, the tiny, tough center of control and order. Soon, it would spread outwards. Which side was it from? The captain is now asking his bridge watch. From whence did the torpedo come? Because the reports are now starting to filter into him on the bridge. Port side, sir, just under A gun. That would be the forwardmost gun in British practice. So the story goes on to talk about how the ship is saved and how she sends a signal where she is telling the port captain of the port to which he's headed, which is probably Plymouth, HMS Marlborough will enter harbor, and it means that she's going to enter harbor under her own power, under her own steam, and with her casualties having been properly cared for, and of course he also had a number of deaths of his ship's company. But at the same time, the captain himself, not showing any fear, but certainly feeling it to the depths of his soul as he fights to save his ship. This is important to me because it means that the idea that the captain's chair is the place from which he will cause his ship to survive is also the place from which I have functioned many, many times in days and times of peril and danger. Both And in particular, in times of heavy weather where the ship needs to be properly handled in order to survive. So it is a wonderful book. It's got many stories in it by the classic writers like Joseph Conrad, but it is the only story that Montserrat has in it, but I highly recommend it. So the magazine this week is once again The Week, which comes to me from the UK. And the issue which just came to me is dated 29 January 2022. And of course, there is at least a week, if not more, of slack time between the time that the issue is published and the time that I get it on the magical Isle of Vashon. And that's because it comes from Europe. So the cover story is Europe on the Brink. Will Putin invade the Ukraine? And of course, he did. And so there's an analysis in there of what Putin may be thinking about using the articles from the press all over the world. I always go to it because I want to see what property is for sale in the UK. And this week, the article is Houses Around the UK Average of £270,000. And to my amazement, there are no houses listed in Cambridgeshire or East Anglia, the ancient kingdom of East Anglia. But there are a couple which certainly have my interest. And one of them is in West Sussex. And West Sussex is one of the counties south of London. And this particular one is called Gearing's Cottage, Warnham, a grade two, and you all will remember the grading system for properties which are considered to be architecturally and historically important enough to save. So this is a grade two. A grade one building is Westminster Abbey, for example. A grade two semi-detached cottage with a unique Horsham stone roof, a wealth of charm and character, and a generous rear garden backing onto open fields. Three beds, a family bath, kitchen, two receptions, which is a kind of a living room equivalent, hall, store, cloakroom with WC, Whiskey Charlie. That means water closet. In other words, a hit. Utility, rear garden, front lawn, £325,000. And I leave it to you to get the equivalency and figure out how much that is in dollars. But I would certainly be looking not at that house because it's in West Sussex. And if I were to buy property, I would buy it certainly in East Anglia and probably in Cambridgeshire. Anyway, we could all repair ourselves to the United Kingdom and start looking at some of these properties. However, I would always return, as I always do, to the magical Isle of Vashon. I've talked before about the leakage of fuel from those fuel tanks in Red Hill, which is right near Tripler Army Hospital. It's also the location of the Coast Guard family housing. And the leakage from those fuel tanks, which started before the end of the year, actually started quite a bit before that, but it was not until some of the leaking fuel had leached into the water supply for people living at Pearl Harbor, in the family quarters in Pearl Harbor, in the family quarters at Hickam, and probably also in the family quarters of the Coast Guard at Red Hill, although I have no report of that. The Navy owns these tanks. They were built in 1943, and they were built to provide a hardened place to store fuel. About 250 million gallons is what these tanks can hold. And they were dug into the hillside and turned into a hardened site. The Secretary of Defense has now decided that the Navy will shut down this underground fuel facility. That leads to a couple of interesting logistical problems. The first one is, how long will it take to clean up the water supply for the people who live in all of those family quarters and all of those military bases that has been contaminated by the leakage of these tanks? So that's the first thing. The second thing is, what will we do now? Where will we store that kind of fuel, that amount of fuel, for all of the ships that touch at Pearl Harbor and at the in particular the Coast Guard base on Sand Island, which is in the Honolulu Harbor. I've been many times to the fuel facility over in Pearl Harbor, and so where are we going to store the fuel? And in particular, should we ever have to have a hardened site, where will we build one? And then what's going to happen with the facility? Are they just going to plug it and leave it and leave all of those tanks once they get all of that fuel out of there? How are they going to do that? This is a much more complex challenge than what I believe anybody thought would happen. I think that originally they thought, well, it's too bad that a little bit of fuel is leaking into the water supply. We'll clean that up, we'll plug that leak, and we'll just carry on as we have since 1943. But it's turning out to be much more complex than that. Certainly it's going to be much more expensive than that. And this is also focused on the need for additional resupply ships, in particular oilers, tankers, that resupply the fleet underway. This is how we got our fuel, Bunker C, black oil, in Vietnam. The oilers would come out from Subic, and we would go alongside every few days in order to refuel. And what this whole situation has disclosed or has brought to the forefront of people's attention is that we are short on the number of oilers, refueling ships, that we have in the fleet, to especially should we need to refuel ships on two or more fronts. I am going to continue to follow this particular case. And I'm reminded of, in particular, the question of, do we just leave the tanks down there and plug them up? In a local situation, Mary R. and I used to live, before we went to the UK, in the town of Issaquah, which is to the east of Seattle. We owned a home out there, and when we went to the UK, we sold it, because they were busy paving over that whole beautiful valley, and we did not intend to go back there. However, in the hills above Issaquah, there are a number of coal mines. There's a town not too far from Issaquah called Black Diamond. And those coal mines are all still there. And periodically, every so often, not periodically, but every so often, a hole will open up on the surface into one of those mines. And they were just left plugged up. In fact, the maps of the mines still are in existence today, and the mines were just plugged up. Are they going to do that at Red Hill with those tanks, or are they going to actually go in, dismantle the tanks, which would be an incredibly difficult and expensive engineering feat? Are they going to dismantle those tanks, or are they just going to plug them and leave them there? So I will be following all of that, because this is a really important story, and it has ramifications much more complex than just, oh, golly, we just need to clean them up and clean up the water so that the people who live in those houses can start taking showers again. The Coast Guard cutter Polar Star, bless her heart, on whom all blessings flow. She has now reached the farthest south of any ship has ever gone, She's 46 years old, and she has been sailing along for all of those years. And this time she went down to the Bay of Whales, which is actually on the Ross Ice Shelf. It's on a huge glacier, the foot of a glacier, which is constantly moving. On the Bay of Whales were Amundsen's base camp when he made the run to the South Pole. For Shackleton, there was the Nimrod, the base for the Nimrod expedition. And our own Admiral Richard Byrd had two Little Americas on the Bay of Whales on the Ross Ice Shelf. I myself have been there and have gotten up really close to it. And one of the reasons why we've been able to go the farthest south is that periodically pieces of it break off, and it is now about 12 nautical miles closer to the south than it's ever been before. And so Polar Star has now made an entry in the Guinness Book of Records, and a hearty well done and bravo Zulu to her, her captain, and all of her fine crew for continuing to keep a 46-year-old ship operating and still about her father's business. And unfortunately and unhappily, she's going to have to keep on doing it for another 5 years, because it's going to be that long before the first of the new and more powerful icebreakers comes into service. We'll be talking more about that as well. The United States Coast Guard cutter Midget has been patrolling the Aleutians for 3 months, and she just returned back to her base in Sand Island. And I mention her in particular because she is about our father's business in the Arctic. And although she has been working around the Aleutian chain where there is no ice, she's pretty thin-skinned. She's not designed to work in the ice. Once again, we need to bring the fleet up to its proper manning level so that we can operate in the high Arctic. And in the high Arctic right now, the only ship that we have that is capable of doing that besides Polar Star, who goes south, is the Coast Guard cutter Healy. And Healy is, I think she's getting ready to go up for a summer expedition to the north. So in the meantime, we're sending these relatively thin-skinned ships. The captains, of course, are being very careful to manage them properly so as not to hold them anywhere. And a well done to her. She's named, of course, for the Midgets. A Midget in particular, but the whole Midget family, with whom I've been shipmates with a number of them from the Outer Banks of North Carolina. They have sent people to the Coast Guard, and before that, the Revenue Cutter Service, and before that, the Life Saving Service from the Life Saving Stations along the Outer Banks of North Carolina. Her home port is in Sand Island in Hawaii, and that's where she is right now getting ready to go out on her next mission. If you're seeking employment in the nautical world, I have an opportunity for you, especially if you live on the East Coast. The Cape May Ferry, which goes from Cape May to Lewis, Delaware, across the Delaware Capes, is seeking in particular mates and ordinary and able-bodied seamen. This particular comes to me from one of my sources, one of my maritime sources, and it is emblematic of the need for mariners in all sorts of operations. Our own Washington State ferry system is desperately in need of people, and in particular, ordinary and able-bodied seamen. So if you live on the West Coast and you want to go to work for a ferry system, the Washington State ferry system would be delighted to entertain your application. The Cape May ferry, Cape May to Lewis, Delaware, one I have taken many times back and forth because I was home-ported in Cape May at one time, And Cape May, of course, is also where the Coast Guard has its recruit training command. You would be welcomed by them. Your application would be welcomed by them. And this is a particularly interesting ferry system because when it started, one of the ferries that they used was a converted World War II LST, landing ship tank. And the Coast Guard manned a number of those during the invasions in World War II. And I don't know whether this particular one was one of ours, but they ran her for many, many years. And she, has only recently been retired. So if you're interested in going back to sea, the Cape May to Lewis ferry system, and you can go on to their website, easily found by Googling it. And so if you want to go back to sea and on the East Coast, check out the Cape May to Lewis ferry system. My cat Sailor is once again back from his extended patrols. And the suitcase is out because next week I will be in Fairbanks, Alaska. And I will be broadcasting live from Fairbanks. And Sailor has figured out that, or this is what he believes anyway, that if he lives in the suitcase, that I will not put anything else in it. And therefore, I will not go away. What I'm hoping is that he decides not to use the suitcase, my current version of my sea bag, that he not choose not to use the suitcase also as his litter box. But being the smartest cat that I have ever had, he has figured this out, and he's not figured out yet that he does not get to decide when and where I go on my travels. So, Sailor, it's time to get your butt out of my suitcase and go find some other place to rest your eyes. The broadcast next week will indeed come to you from the from Fairbanks, Alaska, and I am hoping to be able to broadcast without any difficulties. Lynn, who is on Brown Briefly program on this channel, on this station, will be engineering for me, and between the two of us, we can either screw it up royally or she will come through, as I fully expect that she will. We, I have quickly to say that on the Veterans Health website, I've just gotten some information about both hearing aids for veterans and prescription glasses for veterans. And I recommend that all veterans who need either hearing aids or prescription glasses go to Veterans Health at messages.va.gov. If you just type in Veterans Health, you'll be able to come up with the site. It has a lot of really good information about benefits to which veterans are entitled, and how you plug into those systems. And it has come once again to the end of our time together with still a lot of things that I wanted to cover, never get to. But as always, this is your Captain Joe up in the captain's chair. I am, as always, on station and watching properly. And we never say goodbye. We say until we meet again. And this time we're going to meet again from Fairbanks, Alaska next week. Take care.